This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
MPR wants to hear from you, the listener. How can we improve your experience? What are we doing well? What can we do better? Head to mpr.nz and click on the listener survey button to be taken to a short series of questions that will help us do better. You'll also go in the draw to win a $50 Cafe Royale voucher. That's mpr.nz or find the link on our Facebook page.
Today we have with us
Keith Clark,
Jane Bolton,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Keith, you mentioned that you were banding birds.
Yes. Well, while I was in Blenheim, I got to know a person called Brian Bell very well. Now, Brian worked for the Dominion Museum in Wellington. And so he had a lot of interest in bird banding. Mm-hmm. And so together we set up a sort of team, and he would we would get together and we would go down to Kaikoura with a team, some of my tramping club friends and so on, mm-hmm. help. And we'd go down to Kaikoura on the coast there, and we would band the red-billed gulls for a start.
How would you do that? They wouldn't just sit there and wait.
No, well, we got to the stage where the little poults, as they call them, were mobile, roaming around. And so we would then catch them, and we would put a colour band on their leg and an aluminium band. The aluminium band had a return to Dominion Museum on it, and the other one, the colour told the year. So we would do probably 400 or 500 of them while we were there. Then we also banded black-billed gulls up the Wairau River. There was a colony of black-billeds up there. We would band them. And then we had mist nets as well, and we would sometimes catch birds in these mist nets and band them. And that was
so
all kinds of birds.
What did mist nets look like?
They're just almost like curtains, white curtains.
Oh, like net curtains, yeah.
Net curtains, but much, much wider and mesh.
Yeah.
And you just set them up on a pole or somewhere, and you sort of chase the birds into them. And we did Caspian terns, for instance, on the near the saltworks down there, all that sort of thing. But it did entitle us to do birds anywhere, and there were little rare birds up in the some of the little valleys up the Wairau River, and we'd sometimes be able to catch one of those furred birds, those sort of unusual ones. And also we would be able to we used to explore for birds as well, and on one occasion the two of us spent a week right up on lake on Mount Tapawainuku, which is about 9,500, and we followed around the 6,000 feet mark to see if there were any rock wren in that area that had been mentioned earlier by Hochstetter on one of his explorations. So we used to go and get two otaras for a Canadian museum. We did a lot of that sort of, you know.
Live tuatara?
We had live tuataras in our lounge in Blenheim at one stage.
Yeah.
We used to feed them on our egg yolk, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah,
but there'd be restrictions on that.
Oh yes. Well, this is all under permit. You know,
So you just find them in their burrows, would you, and then take them back?
They would be in the burrows, yes, and they would I think the permit at that stage was we were able to take three.
Yeah.
And they went on to Canada for the museum.
As live animals to be kept in the
museum? Yes, okay. Yes. So that was an interesting part
of it. Now, with the banding, you were banding a lot of birds. Do you know what happened afterwards?
Oh, well, what happened with these birds, there would be a big storm out at sea somewhere, and there would be what we'd call a wreck of birds. Some of the birds couldn't stand the storm, and they'd be killed or die. They would die, and they would wash up on the beach. So there were regular people that people used to regularly patrol the beaches, and when they found birds, they would bag them and send them down to the Dominion Museum. And some of them would have bands on. And some of them, some of the redbills, for instance, they found over in Aussie. They got as far as Aussie. So it was an interesting aspect of it, that they could see the migration of these birds, where they travel to and all that sort of thing. That was all part of the research. A lot of people did a lot of research on that, on that sort of thing.
Okay.
So it was an interesting aspect at the time. So it was good to introduce kids to learn about that sort of thing too. It was good.
And you also mentioned something about a trip to Christchurch.
Oh, yes. Well, I was at Kahatra School.
At which school?
Just a three-teacher school.
Ah, yes.
We thought these country kids ought to experience, you know, something of another part of the world. So we arranged with one of the farmers that we would pick up the potatoes in the summer time, and so we picked potatoes in our spare time at weekends and so on, and we put that money together so that everybody that could go would go. So I just took the standard two to form two kids, and I got the school down the road, they came with me as well. So we got enough money to go on the Rangatira down to Christchurch.
That was overnight.
Overnight.
So the children all slept in the cabins.
Yes.
And that was going from
Kahatra to Christchurch.
From Wellington, the boat went from Wellington.
From Wellington. Okay. So I took about about half a dozen mums with me as well, and another teacher from the school down there, so there were a good team of us anyway, and we had about 40 kids with us this time, and it was fine. We all got on the boat and they were all excited about this, and it came to sort of bedtime, and at that stage there was a call over the blower to say, would the Kahatra mums please come up to the captain's cabin? So all the mums disappeared, and I learnt that the captain was the brother of one of the mums. And what did he do? He filled them all up with gin.
Good boy.
And I had more trouble that night with these mums roaming around and than the kids. And then next morning he called children up at about 5 or 5:30 in the morning, quite early, as we were going into Littleton. And they were up on the wing bridge, able to see the captain manoeuvring the ship right into the actual berth at Littleton, which was great.
Brilliant.
So we had a week there in a hotel. We'd had enough money to go into about a 4-star hotel, you know, and not a 4-star, relatively a big boarding house, I suppose, rather than a
boarding house.
So the kids really thought this was wonderful to have being served at a big table, and they had a big menu to choose from and all that sort of thing. And then we took them to various places, in we took them to factories, and we took them to a lot of good sites in Christchurch, and then we then got back again, and they just loved it.
So how many were there all day? There were about six mothers and you and about
two,
how many
two men and and about 40 kids.
Oh,
They everybody looked after each other, and we'd formed a concert so that a group, you know, we had one Maori boy who was really good on a guitar, and he would lead us, and we'd all sing songs and things like that. Yeah. So,
what was the sign of the Takahe in Christchurch at that stage?
Yes, yes.
So you went there?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, we didn't go up there, but we rode on trams and we did all sorts of things like that. And went to the museum. And,
Antarctic thingy.
No, none of that sort of thing at all. No.
Yeah.
So it was quite an experience for the children, and they came back and they talked about it and they wrote about it. And we made songs and poems up about it. We got a tremendous lift from it in terms of writing and research as well, because we got, with the Dominion Library, I was able to get a whole box of books on Christchurch and all that sort of history and things like that. So they did a lot of background with it.
They'd never forget that, would they?
No, they didn't.
Because the first ships arrived in Christchurch, didn't they?
Yes. Well, some of them, yes. 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 And, as a matter of fact, when was it? They had a reunion there quite a few years ago down at the school. And this group of kids I'd taken through for 3 years there, they said, "Come on, we want to talk to you." So they dragged me into the old classroom and they said, "You conned us. You really conned us. You made us work about twice as hard as anyone else." And we loved it. And they said, we've gone back, and some of them were teachers, and they said, "We've been doing exactly the same thing with our own kids and seeing the improvement that's happened with them." So, it was quite funny, really, but they really had me on. They already got made me sit down on the desk. And now they're dentists and they're farmers and they're all that sort of thing. Teachers. One of the Maori girls there, she was a slimish girl for a general range of Maori children, and she was a good athlete. One of these gymnastic ones that were very good, and she got to Form 2, and I sort of said, "Well, what are you going to do now?" And she said, "Well, Mum and Dad want me to stay home and look after the rest of the children." And I was absolutely aghast at that. So I went to the family and said, please, will you let her go on to secondary school? She's got enough talent to do well at school. And not only that, she's a very good athlete. She'll get some help there, you know. And I said, "Now look, if it's money's a problem, I'll go to the tribal group and get whatever I can get from them." And so I did, and we got her decked out with uniforms, and then she went.
Mm.
Well, now she's the principal of a girls' school in Adelaide.
Amazing, isn't it? What a lucky girl she was.
Well, she deserved it.
That you recognised it.
She does deserved it, yes. And one of the kids I had became the top maths girl in New Zealand at UE level. I'd started teaching them algebra at about standard 4 level, and so.
did you have many Maori?
Yeah,
pupils?
We had about 8 or 10, I suppose. Yes.
Yeah, out of about how many?
80 odd.
Out of 80, okay.
Yeah.
So, were they sort of a distinct group, or they were just...
No, they were just part of it. I did one interesting session that really caught everybody's attention. I decided I would set up a working Maori sort of village, if you like, almost, in the school. So we made a big palisade. The kids all came to school with bits of eucalypts and all sorts of things. You know, and we made a
sort of parsite.
And then we taught, or we made a big adze chopping thing to show them how they used to cut the trees down. We taught them Maori stick games, and we taught them quite a few Maori words at the time, and we greetings and things like that, and we got them flax weaving. We got some of the Maori ladies came in and helped with the flax making and flax weaving and things like that. So we spent we whole term on it virtually, and by the end of that term we had a big day for everybody. And so as the parents arrived, they were greeting Maori, and they were taken round by one of the children, and they would go to group from group, and they would, you know, the group would show them what they could do, and then we all got together and did some singing, you know, Maori songs and things, and so
that was
it was a very successful day, and the Maori tribal group there, they were absolutely overjoyed to think something
that's good.
Happened. And I think the kids actually enjoyed it. One of the kids that was in that, he was Governor Hobson. He did did one of the speeches about Governor Hobson, he got tremendously interested in the history of that sort of thing, and he became the museum next to Te Papa, the Marine Museum.
Oh,
okay. Mm. He became the overseer of that.
The curator.
Gosh,
that's amazing.
Wow. Yeah, he really enjoyed it.
So from there, where did you go? At some stage you came back to Palmerston North.
Yes, but this was... we had 3 years in this country school. Thoroughly enjoyed it. We taught our own children there. It was interesting. And the trip to Australia had sort of given us the bug to travel. So at the end of 3 years, I resigned, Leslie resigned, and we just took a ship to England. I'd written ahead to see if I could get a job over there. And yes, there was replies all around. So we decided to go. And we had the most wonderful trip on the Orsova. Took us 6 weeks to get there. And we stopped on the way. We stopped at Sydney, Melbourne, Fremantle, Colombo, Bombay, Aden, Port Said. We went to Cairo for a day.
So you went through the Suez Canal?
Yes, through the Suez. Then we went to Naples, and then round Gibraltar, and we arrived in Tilbury just the day Churchill died, just beforehand, and I was able to go to his funeral. And really, I cried because I was standing on London Bridge with about 1,000 others, and as his barge came up the river, all the cranes went, and everybody cried.
So all the cranes went down.
It was a very emotional scene at the time. But that was a wonderful trip on the Orsova. It was like a bus, really, because in those days it would drop off quite a lot of people at each stop and take others in, bring all the food aboard, and we'd have 2 days in each of these stops. So there was always buses lined up, or taxis lined up, or, you know, people to take us. For instance, in Bombay, our cabin steward said, "Don't take the ordinary tour. They said, go and find a taxi with a person with a white turban.
Mm-hmm.
He'll be a Sikh, and mm-hmm. he's very honest and very good, and he'll take you. And we did. We mm-hmm. we took a taxi for the day, and it went mm-hmm. all around, all over the place,
mm-hmm.
Into places that the buses don't go.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a wonderful chance for us to see a lot of the world on the way mm-hmm. to that. It took just 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the children were very much looked after. They had a beautiful playroom to go to, swimming pool and all that sort of thing. So it was good.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, very nice.
Good fun.
So where did you start teaching in England? Whereabouts?
Well, we arrived in London and we stayed there for about a week. And then I decided that Bedford was about 80 k's north would be a nice place. So I went up on the train and had a lot wander around and eventually found the education office, and I walked in and said, well, here are my credentials. What chances are there for a job for myself and then for Leslie as well? And they said, when can you start? Tomorrow?
Mm.
So I had to rush back down to London and get a van to bring everything up. And Leslie's principal was a very significant person in the town, and she said, I'll get you a flat. And she got us a beautiful flat in one of those old what they would be, Edwardian, I think, or something, big brick,
yes,
2-3-storied houses.
Oh, yeah.
We had the bottom floor of that, and that was lovely. So, and the two ladies that were our landlords, I suppose, they were lovely. We used to have a great time with them. And
so was the flat furnished, or did you have your own furniture?
Yes, it was furnished. All we had to do was shift in, and we bought a second-hand bed and, that sort of thing. we had all our camping gear with us. So, and I bought a second-hand Cortina, two-door, and put a roof rack on it, and we were all set for travel again. So that was
And your children went to school in England?
Yes, Andrew and Donald both went to my school.
Yeah.
Leslie had a school, and she'll tell you about it, and would be interesting for her to talk about.
Yeah.
She had a school that had mainly Italians and West Indians.
Yeah.
And they were there for London Brickworks because they could handle the heat in the kilns.
Mm.
And their mums, or their dads anyway. And I was in what you'd call here a decile one school.
Mm.
With
So that's changing soon, but you mean for basically low-income families?
Low-income families.
Low socioeconomic
group. Mum was often on the game and Dad was in clink, and that was the sort of background the kids had. The kids were, they were not easy at all. The hardest kids I'd ever taught.
So how did your children get on in that school then?
Well, both did very well. Donald, he loved it. He loved his teacher, Mrs. Binstead, and she loved him, and they got on very well together. And he was about standard one.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrew was in about standard 3 or 4 at the time. He was 10, and he did the 11 plus exam mm-hmm. in the school while he was there, and he came top of that
mm-hmm.
and got offered a scholarship to the very upmarket Bedford. School. Well,
the grammar school.
Yes, the grammar school.
Because the 11 plus in England, they did away with it in probably the late 60s when they moved to comprehensive schooling because it was they thought it was wrong that at 11 children would take an exam and that would determine whether they went to sort of grammar school and maybe university and the professions or to the secondary modern and the trade type or labouring sort of
career. Well, this is the first time the school had ever had a scholarship. And they were appalled when I said, oh no, we're going home at the end of the year. They thought they'd have given their anything to have their own children be able to go there. Yeah. So I thought that was not, you know, terribly good as far as the system was concerned.
Yes, yeah.
I walked into this class and I found out later the class had got rid of teacher after teacher. They'd been a very nasty crowd. And I walked in and the principal introduced me to the class and then left me to it. And I walked around these children. They were sort of sitting at the desk doing something. And there was one boy that really annoyed me a bit. And I said, hey, what are you doing? You should be doing some work. Or he said, I'll do what I like. He picked up a chair and went to hit me with it. So I grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and the seat of the pants and threw him out into the corridor. Well, did that create a sensation? It was probably very illegal there at the time, but boy, it stopped the class in their tracks. I really didn't have any trouble from there on.
Did he come back in the class?
Oh, yes, he came back in, very subdued.
Yeah.
And then they found that I was the only one that had a teaching certificate for swimming. And they had a pool that had hardly ever been used. So I started teaching kids to swim, my class especially. But it changed my complete way of teaching. I couldn't use a formal approach.
Yeah.
I couldn't use the group approach.
Yeah.
But what I could do was use a practical approach. So in the mornings, apparatus and material was no problem there. You could order what you liked. You could get hundreds of pages of white paper or whatever you wanted. So I'd start them off in the morning, perhaps make a kite. But they'd have to do the mathematics of how long and how long and how wide and all that sort of thing. So we'd get maths out of it, and then they'd have to write up how they'd gone about it. So I got English out of that. But I could also have television programs, and that was in the school. So there were a lot of that sort of thing I was able to do. I'd go out and say, well, how are we going to work out the height of that mast there? You know, that flagpole. And that we'd have to try and work out how to do that sometimes. So there were all sorts of things like that that I was able to sort of get them going on.
Now, you said that this was just after Churchill's funeral, so it was 19...
Churchill's funeral, 1965.
65, yes. So for your children as well, going to England, then television would have been something quite unusual.
Yes, quite unusual, yes.
But you had a television there and you watched
that
it?
That was in the school, not in the home.
Oh, you didn't have it at home?
No.
Okay.
No. So, it was a very interesting time, and we had some interesting experiences there. One of the first occasions was tramping. One of the staff said to me, are you interested in going for a tramp? I said, oh, yes, please. So he said, I'll pick you up on Saturday morning. So he duly picked up. And I'd got on tramping boots and I was on a pair of shorts and I was, you know, with a swan dry sort of thing on. I was all set, He turned up with a sports coat on and a tie. Gee, what's going to happen? So we went out and we got to a place out in the country where there was a sort of a stile and obviously a track. And there were some of the other friends had all arrived there and we all got off together. And it turned out it was a lovely stroll.
The English countryside, there's a rule that you're allowed to walk down the edge of fields.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so,
which when I came to New Zealand and I saw all the countryside fenced off, I thought, this is no good. I didn't realise you had all the tracks up into the ranges and so on. But then for New Zealand, if you go for a 1 day tramp, normally you're heading uphill all the way in, you turn around and downhill all the way back. But in England, you can be going up and down and around.
Anyway, we walked across some lovely fields for about half an hour and so on. We saw lots of, you know, animals and things around. And then we turned up at a pub. So we had lunch and a beer at the pub, and then we walked on again after that for another round area, and we eventually ended up at another pub.
You see, so this is the south of England. If you've been in the north, you've been on the North York Moors or into the Pennines or something, a lot more rugged.
So this was to me, it was a country ramble. It was lovely. But anyway, that was one of the funny experiences. We found that we were, with the car and so on, every time we got a break, holiday of any sort, we would pack the car up and away we'd go, and we'd be away for the weekend, and we'd travel to Wales or travel wherever. Yeah. I was fortunate that driving was never any problem for me, so I was able to get on the motorways or whatever it was at the time and go for my life.
Then you could race on them. Now it's traffic jams on the motorways.
You can't do it now.
But it was good then.
The staff would always be interested to find how far we'd been on a weekend. They couldn't believe it sometimes.
Yeah. Exactly. Because going distances in Britain, there's so much within a short distance, you wouldn't normally go very far for something because so much nearby. But you were saying when you were teaching here, there weren't the textbooks and so weren't the resources. And then you went to England and you said, was there a lot of resources? So why weren't they using the English resources in New Zealand?
Don't know.
Okay. So did you bring some of the ideas or materials and books and so on?
Well, yes, I did in the end. It was the time when new math was just starting. And I got interested in that there. And I went to any teacher work that was being done on it there, and I also went to Cambridge once a month to lectures and things there. And so by the time I'd been there a year, I'd had a fair bit of background on Quesnay rods and hundreds of boards and hundreds of tables and you know, all that sort of thing. So it was a interesting sort of professional thing that I could pick up there. And also I was interested, the principal realised that, you know, that we were soulmates almost, and so I wrote a science curriculum for him for the school. And that was something they didn't have, that sort of curriculum thing that we have here. They used to use just a textbook or something like that. I could see a wider range.
You structure something because you didn't have the resource already prepared to follow.
So interesting sort of background. To have that year, we did a tremendous amount of things. I was also, you know, the sort of teachers' union gave me a membership, and so I had some meetings to go to with that. And you know, it was a very different.
Yeah. Did you find it culturally very different being in Britain compared to New Zealand?
Very different from a point of view. The social thing was so different. Yeah. You know, in New Zealand, you go pretty well anywhere without being very formal or anything like that. Whereas over there, you had to say, well, now, you're going to a high tea. Or, what do you wear? You had to ask that. I had to ask that all the time because the first one or two times I went, I was completely out. I'd go in a sports coat and I'd find everybody in suits and ties and things. So there was a sort of a social thing that you had to learn, I suppose.
Yeah.
And what we found though was that we could talk to the whole range.
Yes.
As New Zealanders.
Oh, you mean the class structure? Yes.
Yes, class structure didn't bother us at all. And we
Also they're not defining you, so no. They don't know where
they
to put
where
you.
We are. So we found we could talk to any of the groups, any of the people that way, which was interesting too.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.